I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with author Perry Garfinkel. He's just written a new book called Becoming Gandhi, My Experiment Living with Mahatma's Six Moral Truths in Immoral Times. Wow, you chewed off a pretty big one there.
Very big one.
Yeah. What was the epiphanous moment? What spurred you to write this book?
Well, I was inspired to write this book because it followed the last book I had written, which is called Buddha or Bust, In Search of Truth, Meaning, Happiness, and the Man Who Found Them All. And to be quite honest, my agent came up with this idea. Mm-hmm. She said, why don't you follow up and do Mahatma Gandhi? As you know, Tom, I've been going to India almost every year for a long time. Early days in the 70s, when I was a hippie looking for a guru and some good ganja. But I knew very little about Gandhi, except that his name is plastered all over the place. And
statues.
Exactly. Streets and squares are named after him. And historically, I knew that, you know, he was an important figure in the launching of the revolution against the British rule. But I didn't know the intricacies of his life or the philosophy that I chose to follow to write this book.
But you followed literally in his path. You went to South Africa. You went to England. You went to his hometown in India.
Right. I took the assignment both literally and figuratively, mm-hmm. and I walked in his footsteps. One of the things that jumps out at me is in New Delhi, where eventually he was assassinated in New Delhi, and there's the place where he was staying is now a museum of his life. And there's a patch of pathways that he walked to the platform where he was assassinated that they've now carved out his footsteps. So you can literally walk in his footsteps.
Getting out of sequence, starting at the end.
Okay.
I've always been curious, why was he assassinated? What spurred somebody to kill Gandhi?
It was a zealot Hindu. You know, and this is the part where I actually didn't get into too much in my book because it was going to be a personal journey. But he had, in trying to bring Indians together, he divided them. It augmented the divisiveness between them. So the Muslims and the Hindus were in conflict. And in his attempt to bring them together, it gave rise to more blood. And I think zealot Hindus and Muslims, patriotic Muslims, were torn. Like, they loved India, but India was kicking the Muslims out mm-hmm. to, you know, establish Bangladesh and Pakistan.
So he was killed right around the time of partition?
Actually, he implemented, I mean, he launched the movement. India signed its Declaration of Independence the year before, 1947. Mm-hmm. A year later was his assassination. To jump around again, before we go back to the travel part, one of the most chilling interviews I did for this book, and I interviewed easily 100 people and several Gandhi descendants. The one who most touched me was his grandson, who was living in Rochester. And he had been a journalist. He had written for the Times of India for 30 years. He was a no-nonsense guy. And he said to me, despite what his grandfather had tried to achieve, violence is inherent in man. And it really took me aback, like, well, then what are we doing? What are we trying to do? What did Gandhi achieve? That was a mission for me to see how it could change me, how I could change, and how the places he had been changed or didn't. And because, you know, I'm a longtime travel writer, that part of it was really exciting and juicy and fed me more than the 30-odd books I, you know, leaf through.
So you learned a little bit on each one of your stops in each place you went.
I learned something about the people mm-hmm. and something about Gandhi, about the philosophy, and not to sound too corny, but something about myself.
When your time in South Africa, what did you learn there? What was the most poignant?
It was the most poignant trip, in fact. Many people don't know that Mahatma Gandhi spent very formative years of his life, almost 25 years, in South Africa. He was sent there to be the lawyer for a wealthy Muslim. Gandhi saw how much the Zulus and other black tribes were mistreated, and more so from his point of view, how Indians living there, there was a big wave of Indians that moved there, mm-hmm. were like a class at the same lower class as the blacks were considered by the Afrikaners. So I was quite aware, looking for, is there signs of racism still? And they were everywhere, Tom. We arrived, we stayed at an Airbnb in a suburban section of Johannesburg, which is where Gandhi had based his first law office. And the house we stayed in, and every house in that area, had a toll house, a guard in the toll house, and fencing with spikes at the top. Mm-hmm. And I thought, who are they afraid of? Wow. Who are they, you know, trying to keep out? And then a couple of days later in my travels, I got to interview some blacks who were from the Zulu tribe. And they said, beware, because there's going to be another rising. Because even though blacks had been given positions in high-end society, corruption, nepotism, threats of violence were still rampant. And I thought, you know, poor Gandhi, you know, he had witnessed bloodshed. He was there since, I think, the late 1890s. Mm-hmm. And so that struck me, that how far have we come? How far haven't we come? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, just as a traveling journalist, the beaches of the southern coast of South Africa are beautiful, long stretches of white sand. Yeah. The cities are vibrant.
But again, there's that duality. I spent time in Durban. And again, beautiful sand beach and whatnot, but
that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, yeah, scary undercurrent.
Yes, the downtown is pretty grungy.
Every one of the businesses, they're boarded and padlocked with a code to get in, with a guard at the front door.
Right? Yeah,
and that's in the heart of town.
That is the downtown.
Yeah,
and it's right near where Gandhi got off of a boat coming from India. Mm-hmm. You know, when he first came. He was not just ostracized. There were threats against him. A mob gathered around him.
Wow.
It was not cool.
But again, we think, looking from the outside, of what a pure soul that Gandhi was, and yet one of the accusations, which you alluded to, was his being accused of being a racist.
Yeah. There were allegations that he was racist based on some of the writings that he had written. And I read that stuff. It's full of what now would be considered racist commentary, observations. And then, I think it was less so, be careful how to word this, but Gandhi was picking up the essence of the British approach to everything. He studied law. He went, you know, he graduated from law school.
In England.
In England, and he tried to adapt British ways. And so he was bringing some of that language in his subconscious down to South Africa. And the Black Lives Movement got really upset with him and were had been vandalizing and tearing down statues. There's one in near Davis, California, that was attacked, I guess you'd say. Yeah, he's always been a lightning rod for controversy, because sometimes the ones who go out front to try to change the world, Martin Luther King, others, John F. Kennedy, younger Kennedy. I think that from this all, I've learned that, unfortunately, Gandhi's grandson, but also that xenophobia is unfortunately alive and well. And I don't know why that is. You know, all of the teachings of the great spiritual leaders, Jesus, Buddha, Moses, Muhammad, love is the answer. We're all one. We're all, you know, after those guys, the next generation already, you know, brought their egos into it and tried to separate and hierarchy and all of that.
When you went to England, what did you learn there following in his footsteps?
I went to London and a city called Leicester. In London, I went there because that's where Gandhi went to law school, and he started learning how to, you know, be Western. He went to ballroom dancing classes. He practiced violin. He lived in a district in London, and I went to these places where he had been. I went to the law school, interviewed people there. I saw the house he lived in as an undergrad. I was there on Gandhi's birthday. So the Indian community of London organizes every year. They go to a statue in a park, And I saw that there's respect, continued respect, mm-hmm. but that their Indian community is not integrated into the white community.
In Great Britain.
Well, I'll just say London mm-hmm. for that part. Then, as I was researching, you know, for my book, I was Googling communities that had high pockets of Indians, a high percentage of Indians mm-hmm. in cities. One of them turned out to be Skokie, Illinois, which we can talk about after.
Yeah.
But one of them was Leicester, which is a suburb of London. And what I read was that English people who lived there really didn't want Indians. There were Indians coming from Uganda and Kenya who had moved to that part of the world in Africa from India. Now they wanted to move to England because there were dictators, you know, in Uganda, and Kenya wasn't so great either. But the community in Leicester was famous for, they sent an advertisement in the local paper in Uganda that says, "Don't come. We don't need you. We don't want you." Pretty racist ostracism. Then later I found out that that same city had achieved the unique distinction of being the first city in England that had more, quote, minorities than majorities.
Oh, wow.
More people of color, of mm-hmm. various colors. So this made me want to go and see how well they were integrating now, because it was known as the city that's so bad that they had to, they created a committee to study why there's such antipathy towards Indians. Then now they see themselves as a city, harmonious city. They use the word diversity a lot. And I saw that it was pretty cool that way. There's one thoroughfare that's known as Little India, and it's every shop is Indians. So it's interesting when we talk about xenophobia, communities of like-minded people, ethnic origin, tend to huddle together. I've seen it in the communities I grew up in. I'm Jewish from New Jersey. The street I grew up on, there were like 25 houses. There were three non-Jewish families there.
Oh, wow.
So there's like that congregation mm-hmm. mentality. It was white, and the whites were divided into Jews and Italians. Uh-huh. And you and I were talking before, when I was living there, my friends and I can't remember more than two black people mm-hmm. in K through 12. This would have been in the 50s and 60s. Now, West Orange, the town I grew up in, which is 17 miles as the crow flies from Midtown Manhattan, it's 26% African American.
Oh, interesting.
So there's an interesting demographic shift, and mm-hmm. the next book I'm writing is a kind of look at the town I grew up in and the period I grew up there. In a way, paying forward what I, you know, read about racism in Gandhi's time.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about your time in London, South Africa, but you spent a lot of time over decades exploring India and Gandhi's path.
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
Well, the first time I went to India, my then wife and I had decided that if Richard Nixon got reelected, we were going to leave the country. And when Nixon was elected, we just took out a map. Mm-hmm. Yoga was in the air and Eastern things were in the air. And we decided to go to India. We were going to follow a guru.
Were you into Gandhi then? Or
no,
was it that,
okay, not so. At all. I mean, I saw the towns, you know, his name all mm-hmm. over the place. But I was very one-pointed at that point about, like, the guru. And I studied Indian music because I play drums. Then, when 2003 came around, I got this major assignment from National Geographic magazine to write about why Buddhism had risen in popularity. And I convinced the magazine that the answer lay in the East. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time I went back to India after 2003. It was like February of 2004. And I saw India with a new pair of eyes. And culturally, sociologically, and spiritually. So I went back in 2004. I went almost every year until COVID. I was working for a big Indian hotel company, the Taj Hotels. Mm-hmm. Then I was working for a Maharana family in Udaipur, Rajasthan. And I was writing a book. And so every year until 2020, then I couldn't go anymore. And it was 2019 when I got this go-ahead to write this book after I had been pitching it for several years. but there was like a coalescing of energies that made it timely. Because when I first came up with this idea, it was when Barack Obama was running and elected the first time, and we found out that he attributed his philosophy to not Martin Luther King, but Mahatma Gandhi. And I only then did the research that, oh, Gandhi inspired King and more. You know, all the nonviolent protests come from this guy, Mahatma Gandhi. And that's when I engaged with the idea.
What were some of the key tenets that resonated with Obama and Martin Luther King about Gandhi?
What resonates are like the two pillars that you could say run through all great religions. The search for truth and peace, nonviolence. So Gandhi, you know, is credited with developing nonviolence as a political tool. I think that part of it was compelling to Obama. Obama was spoke to or said to have represented the community. And, you know, in India, in Hinduism, you call it the satsang, which is the community, the spiritual community. I think that part appealed to Gandhi, and also the peace part, nonviolent way. The uber question is, how can you change people's minds and their behaviors? You know, Gandhi's most famous quote is, be the change you want to see in the world. Mm-hmm. And in fact, why I knew Obama was into him was that line from Gandhi was echoed in Obama's campaigns, be the change. So I think Gandhi was considered a change agent. Obama wanted to think of himself as a change. Just being the first black president was an agent of change.
When you were meditating on writing this book, I seem to recall that you thought at one point about titling it Being Gandhi. And then you went, no, I don't think so.
Right. I think it was a little pompous. And once I got into it and realized how arduous a journey this would be, because I'm going to tell you the six principles I followed, I thought there's no way to be Gandhi. His bar was too high. And also times have changed so that one would have to kind of shift to adjust. And so I realized becoming was a state that artists enjoy or should enjoy, that you always want to be in a state of becoming, achieving, because once you achieve, it's game over.
Maybe it's the journey is the thing, not the destination.
Right. Yeah, the journey more than the destination. Yeah. And that way, you know, I'm eternally working on becoming Gandhi. Even when I mess up, my default is, oh, would Gandhi have done that?
Of all your times and years in India, what first comes to your mind about relative to Gandhi in your time there? I enjoyed some of your writing about traveling with the professor and whatnot. That was cool.
Yeah. One of the things that I, you know, was reinforced is how difficult it is to travel in India. As even a, you know, journalist with a carte blanche or a traveler, you know, a lot of people, friends of mine, have done the tour with a group, and they go to Delhi, Agra, and Bangalore, or somewhere, Jaipur. But India is like that classic story of the elephant and the blind men. Eight blind men were asked to describe an elephant, and one of them said, oh, it's a very smooth and has a pointy edge. Another said it's flappy, and, you know, and each of us has a different, you know, sense of India depending on where we went. That part was reinforced in this trip. And the disparity between money, wealth, which there is people with great wealth there, and what's happening on the streets. And some people, it's not a country you want to feel comfortable traveling to, just because it's like you're bombarded with noises, smells, things you'll see that you'll never forget. When I was there in 1973-4, there's an image there from that time that has stayed with me forever. A freaky kind of image of a guy pushing himself on a platform on wheels.
No legs.
No legs. So that part of India is very poignant. You know, the upside is that between 1973, when I was there, then again over the early 2000s, and again 2019 and 2020, people are rising. There's aspiration. and there's achievement of the aspirations, which were very difficult to achieve, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And now there's a middle class, and there's a lot of independence people. I find Indians to be very entrepreneurial. So, you know, like a company the size of your sound booth here could be somebody's hopes and dreams of a better life. And they work hard. They work 16-hour days. Mm-hmm. They're up at 4 in the morning. There's that, and something, you know, that I continue to take away. It's a fascinating country. So we talked about England. We talked about India generally. But the other experiences I had in India, I want to tell you about one. There's a city called Porbandar, where Gandhi was born.
Mm-hmm.
It's a seaport town on the northwest area of Gujarat, which is the state Gandhi's from. It was infamous recently when these Arab terrorists came from that city to Mumbai and attacked the Taj hotels, and there was a terrorist attacks, and it's called 2611. It's their version of our 9/11.
Yeah.
But I was led to meet some people, an environmentalist, an older guy who had retired professor, who was telling me that the irony of where Gandhi, who was, like you could say, India's first environmentalist, environmental consciousness anyway, there was a cement company owned by one of the very big name families in India, and they were allowing effluents from the concrete factory into the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy said, "Do you see that black area out there? That's the effluents." And I was just astounded that this could be going on. So I further investigated and went out of town, somewhere outside of Porbandar. There's a French woman who had an ashram, and she was raising money for a school across the street that she had helped start. And then she led me to these farmers who were complaining that there was illegal limestone mining going on, and the lime was drifting down into their fields. Pretty, you know, robust, I forget what they were growing. I want to say soybeans, but it could be wheat. And I was standing there on the top of this hill with these guys who were explaining how this happened. It was one of those journalistic moments, like I saw the news, and there was no denying.
Yeah.
You cannot put a spin as they explained it. And then I said, I want to see where the actual like mining of the limestone. They showed me that, and then they showed me where they took these big blocks of limestone and broke it down, like a machine, like a grater, and the whole sky in this cavernous area, there was dust everywhere. And I was full of white dust. It was unsettling. And I thought, these poor guys are in this every day.
Yeah.
They're going to die young, all because of greed, like illegal mining.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be happening. And I could see why, because there's no control. And it's going to ruin these kids' lives. And the farmers were, you know, really upset about the impact. I don't think they had means of protest or stopping the action.
A little bit more about following in the footsteps of Gandhi in India.
India?
Yeah. You talked about going to his hometown.
Yes. Actually, in Mumbai, he lived in Mumbai for a good number of years while he was actually authoring the Declaration of Independence. It's called Mani Bhavan. And it's beautiful now. It's a museum and a library. And I got Gandhi's great-grandson to meet me there. And I interviewed him. And he walked me up these steps. And up the first flight, I saw this school of young girls reciting their essays about Gandhi.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really cute. And I saw that the Gandhi philosophy is getting the trickle-down effect, getting kids to write an essay. And it seemed kind of parroting, but it was the effort. Then we went up a flight, and there was the room where Gandhi lived in. And they now have blocked it off as, plexiglass over it. And it was a very simple room.
Mm-hmm.
Just a bed, his spinning wheel, where he would place his papers and his books.
You tried to become a spinner, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Well, I'll tell you that. But it was very poignant because here was his great-grandson looking into this room where Gandhi, mm-hmm. his great-grandfather, had written some really important treatises and is treated as sacred, very sacred. The equivalent would be like George Washington here. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we have the kind of reverence for Washington as they do for Gandhi. What was the thing you asked me about?
You're spinning.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you...
I took it on.
Yeah.
Gandhi was famous for reintroducing the charkha, it's called, the spinning wheel, to promote the idea that Indians can make their own cloth with their own cotton and not ship the cotton to England, have it turned into cloth, and then sent back to India to sell at a much higher price. So I decided, and trying to become Gandhi, I would try to learn how to spin. But the problem was, I was already back in the States mm-hmm. when I, you know, could find the right woman to teach me. And we were having like nightly Zooms with this spinning. Key is how the pressure you put on the cotton to turn it into yarn. So it was really difficult because she couldn't take my hand. It was not visceral. Mm-hmm. It was all mental. You know, because I'm a writer, I wove metaphors out of it.
But you finally got it when you stopped trying so hard, right?
Yes, sir. The metaphor was, I'm trying too hard. You have to kind of let go sometimes and let it happen. Mm-hmm. You have to find that balance between too much pressure and not enough pressure. And I came away thinking, there's some things in life maybe I'm pushing too hard for that aren't necessarily going to come to pass. Mm-hmm. So cool it, you know, back off. Lighten up your grip,
yeah.
And maybe then it'll happen. Because when you do lighten up the grip, sometimes it catches, mm-hmm. and you can pull it.
Another context relationship there was the salt tax and his hiking and traveling.
Yes.
Talk to us about the salt tax.
The salt tax. So like the Boston Tea Party, Indians felt that they were taxation without representation. That's the American version. Indians were being taxed for salt that was taken from the ocean and then shipped to England again, turned into Morton salt or whatever, mm-hmm. and mailed back for your table salt. And it was illegal to pick salt from the ocean shores.
Yeah.
So Gandhi led what came to be known as the Salt March from his ashram in a city called Ahmedabad. It's a 240-mile trek that he enacted. People followed him from village to village, and I decided I was going to do that too. And my metaphor was, while Gandhi was, you know, proposing that we don't need to be shackled by this tax, I had been through two hip replacements, and I thought, I'm going to prove to myself that I can unshackle myself from the burden of my body. It worked, but it didn't work because, and part of, you know, the lesson of my book is times change. You can't exactly replicate that time. When Gandhi did the walk, there were dirt roads and little pathways, cow paths. And now it's like it'd be super highways mm-hmm. with trucks, school buses, cars, but with people who barely know how to drive, in my estimation, rickshaws and everything. So what we did was I was driven from village to village, but I'd start at one and I'd get off the car, out of the car, and walk through the village with my host, who was a professor of heritage management. He was an architect who knew the Gandhi story. So we could be like standing in a plaza in a little village, and he'd say, from that balcony, imagine there were 1,000 people standing in this little area. So I got to experience it, and I saw a piece of India that I'd never seen before. Some of it is very pastoral. Like, I could walk for hours without seeing somebody other than scooters going by. And the last 15 miles, I walked straight through without stopping. And when I got to the beach, I was so ecstatic. You know, it was like seeing a cross-section of India. My mantra was, what would it be like then compared to now? And along the way, I bought a stick, a walking stick, because Gandhi is often seen with this bamboo walking stick. So I bought one. And the last 15 miles when I was walking, There were people, you know, sitting on their porches, very like 15 miles from, it's called Dundee Beach. And when they saw my walking stick, they knew that I was on a Gandhi pilgrimage of some sort.
That's really cool.
And rather than looking at you askance, you know,
what are you doing here?
Who is this white guy? They were like, namaste.
That's really cool. Oh, I love it. Little epiphanous moments.
Very, you know, touching.
An underbelly of the whole Indian experience, and especially in Gandhi's time, this was during the British rule, the Raj, basically 100 years. They did give you a legacy, which is education, language, and whatnot, that has served India quite well.
Well, I have a thought about that, Tom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why I bring it up.
I knew you would. I think what the West brought to India was organization.
Made the trains run on time, that was saying.
Bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So, but they sort of gave Indians an infrastructure that they hadn't had. I remember once, and this was in the 70s, we took a train. We had made a reservation somewhere, and we went to the desk, and the guy opened a ledger, deep ledger, many, many pages, and he's scrolling through looking for a name. And even in the 70s, we would have had some other kind of system here in the West. But I thought, I remember standing there thinking, this is going to take forever. Mm-hmm. But miraculously, they come up with some answers. I think the bad thing the Brits did was kind of brainwash the Indians into subservience. Mm-hmm. And this is what, you know, England did with other colonies. They turned them into subservient colonists, colonized people. And I find that Indians have this great adoration for things British. And I can never understand why that is, because they did a number on Indians that is now this generation is very much pulled away from that influence. The Rajas that you talked about, I actually worked for a family in Rajasthan, the Mewar family. They're called Maharanas, not Maharajas, but it's a gradation of difference. And they come from a tradition that goes back to the year 734, that their family have been the sovereign rulers of Udaipur for that long. And that is a real lineage, 57 generations, something like that. And I saw that, and I saw how Indians, the young modern Indians, look at that discouragingly, disparagingly. And yet they're part of the tradition that that's respected. They have no power like the king of the Queen of England. But when they go through the streets, people are, you know, bowing and stopping in the streets. Like they are seen culturally as leaders with a lot of authority and respect. So it's a sort of strange disconnect, because modern India is moving away from that. Independent entrepreneurs. And all the Indians who come to America and get their PhDs and become doctors and lawyers and engineers, flies in the face of the ceremonies you see from the Maharana people. But they also had been, by virtue of their history, accrued a lot of real estate. The ones I worked with had turned their palaces into hotels, and that's a tradition throughout India. The good ones left a legacy of environmental consciousness, like the Mewars have done. And again, this entrepreneurial spirit, what are we going to do with this palace that's now not serving as the central meeting place of everybody in the region?
Yeah.
Let's turn it into a hotel.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And then there was another country I went to. It's called America. And I went to Skokie, Illinois, because I'd read that there was a high percentage of Indians there. And Skokie, it was infamous as a Jew because there was a protest about a Nazi marchers who were going to march through the town of Skokie, city of Skokie, which is like a suburb of Chicago. Mm-hmm. There was litigation involved, and they were allowed to march because it upheld their right to free speech. Mm-hmm. And Skokie then was populated with Jews. There was a high population of Jews. Strangely, a lot of them were Holocaust survivors.
Right.
So they had even more reason to oppose the Nazis, Nazi marches. But the Nazi marches continued. Mm-hmm. And now Skokie has a high percentage of Indians.
Oh, interesting.
Just like that Leicester in England, mm-hmm. it's like a sister city kind of relationship. In my mind, they've turned the corner. And as this very harmonious, integrated city.
And you went there.
Yeah, and I went there and interviewed people. And, you know, sometimes you go to somebody's house in suburban Chicago, and you walk in their house, and it feels like India. It's got the smell of incense. It's got mm-hmm. the smell of masala. It's got the puja, the worship table for their guru and gods. And I enjoy that because otherwise, Indians who move here, knowing what the culture is like there, always noisy, always people, mm-hmm. always intense. The street life is crazy. Now they live in suburban wherever. You know, you can hear a pin drop. And I wonder, maybe they're not used to it. Mm-hmm. It takes an adaptation for them to get used to what they came here hoping for.
Yeah, or at least the next generation.
It takes a few generations, yeah. And the kids, until the kids are saying, India, where's that?
That's interesting. Mm. So now you're ready to go back.
Who said that?
Reading between the lines.
But it's interesting you bring it up. I was going to tell you personally before. Last week, I had about 2 weeks ago, I was waiting to hear about an invitation to come back to India and speak at some of the literary festivals, and I wasn't. And I had decided I'm done with India. And just as I was, you know, saying that to the gods, a week or so ago, some representative of the Indian government wanted to invite me on a tour, mm-hmm. press trip, to Delhi, Agra, and Bangalore. The timing was too soon. It was like leaving tomorrow.
Right.
But I counter-proposed that I go in January to somewhere I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to go?
It's a city that I was talked about before, Ahmedabad. It's where Gandhi really sort of staged his movement. But it's also first, what is it called? It's the first heritage city, UNESCO.
Mm-hmm. It's the first in India.
It's the first UNESCO mm-hmm. heritage city in India.
Oh, cool.
And there's a lot of cool stuff there, architecture. There's an old hotel like from the 1890s, the rooms have fans and all the woodwork,
yeah.
And a few other interesting things. So I want to go there.
That's really cool.
India's been good to me. Do you want to talk about the six principles?
Yeah, real quick.
Okay.
We're getting close to our
I figure.
Producer going, you guys are out of here.
Lights are going off.
Okay. Yes, I definitely want to hear about the six principles.
You know, part of this was not just traveling in Gandhi's footsteps. I wanted to become Gandhi. And he put forth six principles. Some people say 11, but I went with the six. And ways to live a more moral life or a more conscious life. Those were living truth, nonviolence, simplicity, celibacy, vegetarianism, and faith. And so I took on going hyper-focus on how could I live more faithfully. What is faith? I mm-hmm. think that was my operating question. And each chapter breaks down my attempt to live these principles in a daily practice. And it was a struggle. You know, I could go into each one of them, but it turned out as difficult to live today as it was to walk the salt march, you know, in Gandhi's time today. Mm-hmm. Those were the deeper parts that really moved me and have changed me. So I take all of this very seriously. And some of them just touch us today even more so. Truth. You know, the current administration talks about fake news. We didn't have a phrase like that. We trusted the news. Do you remember who America named the most trustworthy man in America? Walter Cronkite.
Walter Cronkite, without a doubt.
Walter Cronkite was the man Americans said they would trust the most. Mm-hmm. And look where we are now. There's, you know, nobody trusts anything in the news.
Yeah.
And I'm a newsman. And then truth on a deeper level. What is your truth? What is your purpose in life? Who are you when you take off your accoutrement of current times? That was challenging. Nonviolence, you know, I found ways, each of these, to live more nonviolently. Like, for instance, what you can do for yourself is don't let violence into your life. Even the simple stuff like watching violent television, movies that I used to love, now I count, do a head count, Gladiator. And then I reflected back when I was a kid, we saw Cowboys and Indians and the cowboy, you know, TV shows, and we took it for granted. There's ways we can look at violence and ways we can live more less violently by eliminating the influences. So there's that. And then simplicity. I actually called a moratorium on buying stuff for a year and a half. And I realized I have things I never have worn. So I went through my closets. I gave away stuff to Goodwill. And the whole use of devices, it's crazy. I live right near UC Berkeley. And I see students crossing University Avenue, looking down into their phones with a headset on, yeah, oblivious. And cars are supposed to stop when people walk across the street. But that's happening less and less frequently. Mm-hmm. I'm just worried about that. And not only that, but the impact on their whole, on their lives, how their view of the world is, you know, down to a frame of 3x5.
Yeah.
So, you know, I followed with all of them. Vegetarianism. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a meat and potatoes family. We had steak because we could afford it. Mm-hmm. And there are certain foods that represent you living the good life. So I became a vegetarian for a while. Then I found that it really, I craved, I guess, some kind of protein other than what you can get as a vegetarian. So now I'm a pescatarian. So I think overall my philosophy became taper down. Like you can't be Gandhi, you can strive to become Gandhi. And in my travels I found, you know, that was travel in my head. But if you can, like, travel abroad, mm-hmm, and also keep these principles in your head, it's harder, but it's better. Because then you really see that, you know, I've become that.
Do you ever dream about Gandhi? Does he ever come visit you in your dreams?
No, Tom. But I do have, a large portrait of Gandhi that hung over my head in my writing room. And I've moved 2 months ago, and I've been looking for where I can put this, mm-hmm, because it will keep me keeping him in mind. Yeah, yeah. Keep me humble.
So he's going back up.
He will be brought back. No, I feel like, you know, the good interviewer will say, what's your next book, Perry? Are you going to do another book than the spiritual leaders?
Well, being an author myself, my first question would be, what best way in your mind would you see to help promote this book? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of potential out there.
Yeah, I tried some things, and I feel like the word Gandhi puts it in a pigeonhole that Americans think it's too esoteric. Mm-hmm. You know, it's too long ago. What relevance does he have? And that is a through line of this book, Becoming Gandhi, that, yes, these are more relevant than ever. Mm-hmm. To your question, you know, I've done a couple of things. For instance, I've written to 25 centers for the study of truth or study of peace and nonviolence throughout the country. And 3 of the 25 responded. And in fact, twice I've gone to speak at the University of Rhode Island to there's a center for the study of peace and nonviolence run by the director who's a Tibetan monk with a PhD. That would be one way to promote it. Reviews and profiles was, you know, sort of what you think would be the, mm-hmm, easy stuff.
Yeah.
That's the hardest stuff.
Interesting. Well, you, in your book, you have a letter from the Dalai Lama.
Not a letter. He wrote the foreword.
That's so cool.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
That was a game changer. The publisher thought, oh my God, that's a game changer. I knew somebody who knew somebody, and I had interviewed him 20 years ago for National Geographic, uh-huh, and he remembered that book, so I kind of parlayed that into at least a...
Where did you interview him?
I interviewed him in India, uh-huh, at the Tibetan Government of Exile in Dharamsala in the northern part of India. I had interviewed him then, 2004 it would have, uh-huh, been. So I didn't interview him for this because he was in ill health and, mm-hmm, overwhelmed, and I wasn't going to try to go for, yeah, a twofer.
Okay. Perry, to learn more about you and your new book, Becoming Gandhi, where would you direct somebody?
Go to my website, Perry Garfinkel, GARFINKEL.com. The homepage, the landing page has all about my book and a click through to that book. And by the way, the book has now been published in 5 countries.
Oh, cool.
So there's a link to the publishers in Brazil, Germany, Portugal, America, and India. Cool. The American publisher is Sounds True, which was known as an audiobook publisher, but now they're doing many books of this caliber.
Where are they located?
Their home office is in Colorado. But as we were talking about earlier, a lot of the staff work remotely now.
Right.
But Colorado is their home base. Mm-hmm. They're a very good publisher. Very proud to be with them.
Perry, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you very much.
You had me captivated the last 4 days reading your book, Becoming Gandhi, My Experiment Living the Mahatma's 6 Moral Truths in Immoral Times by Perry Garfinkel. Thank you.
Thank you. It was nice to be here.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.
Jira Mabhivata.